Yes, that's Welcome to Animal Voices here on CFRO 102.7 FM. That's Vancouver's Co-op Radio. We have a great guest for you today. It's going to be Dr. Stanley Coren. But before I bring him on, I have a couple of announcements for you. You might want to grab a pen and paper because there's some events that you might like to know about. While you're grabbing that, I just want to make a correction. Last week we had Deborah Probert on from the Vancouver Humane Society, and She made a mistake in her information, and she'd like that corrected. She said that the Olympic venues of Vancouver, Richmond, and Whistler, each council was encouraging everyone to buy free-range eggs. The mistake was free-range eggs. They are actually encouraging everyone to buy certified organic eggs. Certified organic is the highest category. It's higher than free-range eggs. So people who are concerned about chickens and the suffering that they go through and they don't want to contribute to that suffering and torturing with their dollars, please buy certified organic eggs. Now, there's a walk for animals that is going to be taking place Sunday, October 14th. And the location will be at a second beach in Stanley Park. The meeting time is 11:30. There's a registration fee of $10. And if you register today, September 14th, you will get a free t-shirt. That will be included. The walk time starts at 12 noon. You can register online at www.walkforfarmanimals.org/locations/Vancouver.htm. The Walk for Farm Animals events are held in cities across North America throughout September and October. And in addition to promoting awareness about inhumane factory farming practices, the walkers raise vitally needed funds to help Farm Sanctuary sustain and ensure farm animal rescue, protection, rehabilitation, and humane legislative efforts. So all the money raised for this event will go to Farm Sanctuary. And they operate two shelters that provide lifelong care for hundreds of animals rescued from stockyards, factory farms, and slaughterhouses. So, again, you can register online by email, or you can do it by mail. You can send a check to Farm Sanctuary, to Joanne Chang, P.O. Box 14334, Granville Island, Post Office, Vancouver, V6H4J6. And again, if you register today, you will get a free t-shirt. So again, that website is www.walkforfarmanimals.org/locations/Vancouver HTM. Now, another great event coming up, mark your calendars, in 2 weeks, starting September 29th and 30th, is the Taste of Health Veggie Food Fair. It goes both days. What it is, it has speakers, it has vendors, it has a book fair, cooking demonstrations, all kinds of things going on. It's a great event that they do every year. The admission is $7. If you're a member of EarthSafe, you get in for free. If you want more information about that, please go to www.earthsafe.ca. Okay, now we have a fascinating guest today. He is Stanley Coren, and Dr. Coren is he's best known for his books on dogs, but he's also a scientist and a professor of psychology at UBC. He's done his undergraduate degree in psychology from the University of Pennsylvania and his doctorate in psychology from Stanford University. He's currently a professor in the Department of Psychology at UBC, and he's also a director of the Humane Neuropsychology and Perception Laboratory there. His research has covered many areas in psychology, including human vision and hearing, neuropsychology, brain, laterality, handedness, birth stress, sleep, behavior, genetics and cognitive processing. He's a prolific researcher and has published over 300 items, including research reports in well-respected scientific journals. He's also published 14 books and monographs for professionals and students. One of these books is the textbook Sensation and Perception, which has been the most used college text in North America courses on sensory and perceptual processes. He's won a number of awards for his research, and he currently lives with three dogs and a cat. So he's been also studying dog behavior and writing books about dogs. He's also an instructor with the Vancouver Dog Obedience Training Club, which is a nonprofit organization which supports beginner dog training in the community for the general public, as well as advanced dog training for dog handlers who wish to compete in dog obedience competitions in local and national events. So he and his dogs have also been members of numerous award-winning precision dog obedience teams, and he's also created choreography for other teams. He is a supporter of the SPCA and has participated in numerous functions and fundraising activities aimed at providing shelter and finding homes for dogs. He's been on many popular TV and radio programs, and his work has also been covered by many popular newspapers and magazines. So it is with great pleasure that I welcome you to the show, Dr. Korn. Are you there, Dr. Korn? Are you there, Dr. Korn?
Can you hear me?
Yes, there you are.
All right. There's a Dybbuk in the system. My grandparents were from Eastern Europe, and Dybbuks were special little demons which only inhabited machinery.
I'm sorry, say that again. I couldn't quite hear you. My earphones went funny. Go ahead.
Okay, well, anyway, I'm here.
Good.
Okay.
Great. All right. Well, gosh, your resume is so impressive. What caused you to be also fascinated with dogs?
Well, I've had dogs all of my life, and I've trained them and competed with them, and that sort of thing. So, and as a psychologist, I am a bit different than most other psychologists. I am dual trained in the sense that most psychologists are trained either for human psychological work or for animal psychology, and I'm trained for both.
I see. So tell us a little bit about what animal psychology covers.
Well, you have to think of it this way. I mean, my interests are really in the human-animal bond. So I'm interested in our relationship to our animals, and very specifically dogs. But in order to understand that bond, you have to understand both animals at either end of the leash. So that means to say you really have to understand something about human psychology, and you have to understand the psychology of the dog. And without that, you can't understand the bond. So some of my research, like the research which ended up in the book How to Speak Dog, really tends to focus very, very strongly on the dog and what he's saying to us and how we often misinterpret him and that sort of thing. Whereas some of my other work, like the Paw Prints of History, really have to do with the way in which dogs have influenced the people who have gone on and changed history. So different bits and pieces of my research have sort of emphasized either the dog or the person, but always acting together.
Well, that makes perfect sense. So I wanted to ask you with that in mind, because we have had recently in the news with this whole dog fighting thing, people have heard me talk about it on the air. This is Allard, by the way, I didn't mention my name. And, you know, obviously the owners who have these dogs that they put into dog fights really do not care about the welfare of their dogs. And yet I've also read that in the example of, say, pit bulls, for example, that in spite of the fact that they get all of this abuse, that quite often they can still be friendly towards humans.
Well, there are a few things which you really have to understand. I think that this whole business having to do with Michael Vick, the Atlanta Falcons quarterback, who has just confessed to being involved with dogfighting, has brought, at least to the general public, much more awareness of the fact that there is a very extensive underground which is associated with dogfighting. But this has been going on for many, many years, and it's really quite huge. I mean, people have no concept of the size of this and the number of people involved. For example, the U.S. Humane Society has data which suggests that over 40,000 people earn their total annual income from activities associated with dogfights. In addition to that, there is a huge underground, and a lot of money changes hands. The dogs which are used for fighting are quite expensive. They start at about $5,000 a pop, and you can increase from there. A huge amount of betting is done at dogfights. So there's a lot of money involved, and that's one of the reasons why people like Vic got involved, because it's, you know, high-stakes gambling and that sort of thing. Now, as far as the dog fighting goes, the dogs which are most typically used are American Pit Bull Terriers, Staffordshire Terriers, and American Staffordshire Terriers. And you must understand that these dogs are being specifically bred by these individuals for fighting. And this is really a form of selection, which we would call a hard selection procedure. The simple technique which they use is that the dogs which win fights are bred, and the dogs which lose fights are culled. That's another way of saying they're simply killed. They're certainly not used as breeders. And the more fights a dog has won, the more valuable that dog is and the more valuable his offspring are. And what this does is this selectively changes the genetics of the dog, so that these particular breeds, these particular dogs of these breedings become extremely aggressive and easily triggered. I'll tell you how bad it is. It's so bad that the female has to be taken away from the litter when the pups are around 5 weeks of age, or she will kill them. Now, I mean, in addition to the breeding, of course, the dogs are also trained and made to be much more aggressive. Now, this process is called game breeding. I mean, you're breeding the dog for this gameness, which really means that the dog is aggressive and will fight on even through its own pain. And that's become sort of a code word. If you go on the internet and you put in the words game bred dogs, that will produce a whole raft of hits, which would include kennels which are clearly breeding dogs for fighting. I mean, these are kennels with names like Combat Kennels, Hard Bite Kennels, No Mercy Kennels, Armageddon Kennels, and that sort of thing. Michael Vick's kennel was called Bad News Kennels, for example. And these people, I mean, although if you look at the kennel things, they'll have a disclaimer which says, you know, we really don't want you to use these dogs for anything illegal, and dog fighting is illegal in all provinces in Canada and in all states in the U.S. You know, it'll then go on to say that they have dogs which won't back down to anything with fur on it. So, I mean, it's quite obvious that these dogs are... I mean, you're not going to go to a kennel with the name No Mercy Kennels to go buy your family pet. Mm. Now, the game bred dogs are, as I said, selectively bred for this particular attitude and this particular temperament. There are kennels out there which are breeding lines of Staffordshire Terriers and American Staffordshire Terriers, which do not have game bred dogs in their bloodlines. And those, in fact, are the dogs which turn out to be, you know, the sweet family dogs. But you have to be very careful. I mean, you really need a five-generation pedigree, and you need to know something about the dogs and the kennels which are in a particular line. The so-called pit bulls, which, as I said, includes the American pit bull and the American Staffordshire and the Staffordshire, you know, back around the turn of the 20th century, I mean, these were family dogs. I mean, you know, Petey from the Little Rascals was an American Pit Bull Terrier. And Nipper, who is the dog who is from the RCA logo, you know, listening to the megaphone of the record player, was a pit bull. And in fact, in World War I, the symbol for the war, faithful but won't back down, was a pit bull. And there were lots of people who had pit bulls. I mean, Fred Astaire had a pit bull. I mean, you know, and so
then does it really then comes down to, I mean, a lot of these dogs were friendly throughout history and everything, and then you take them and you breed them and you push them to be aggressive and all that sort of thing. But if you took, say, those aggressive dogs that have been involved in dog fights, and then you maybe you bred them or whatever, but their offspring you nurtured and treated lovingly, they aren't necessarily going to...
No. They are going to be dangerous.
Really? Even the offspring, if they're taken away from the mother and they're brought up in a whole different environment?
You must understand that the breeding is in many respects, in these instances, just about the single most important factor. Obviously, you can take a good dog and turn him bad. You can take a bad dog and make him less bad, but still not safe. Look, this particular breeding experiment started way back in the early 1800s. At that point in time, there was still bull baiting and bear baiting and dog fights. And then what happened was that in Britain, Parliament in 1835 passed a law banning the pit sports. And so at that point in time, people could go in several different directions. What some people did was that they decided that they would use their dogs, which had been used to fight bears and bulls and other dogs, specifically to fight dogs. So they started to breed them with terriers, the bulldogs and terriers, which is where we got the bull and terrier crosses. They began to breed them to be faster and dog aggressive and aggressive generally. At the same time, some of the other people decided, well, we would like dogs who look like fighting dogs, but in fact are really gentle in temperament. So that's where we get our current bulldog. I mean, our current bulldog is a pussycat. He looks ferocious, but he is a pussycat. Okay, we also get the bull terrier, which everybody tends to throw into the same mix with the Staffordshires and the American pit bulls, and they are not. I mean, this is a case where the poor beast has been lumped in because it has bull and terrier in its name. What happened there was a character by the name of Hinckley decided that he wanted a dog which looked like a fighting dog but was a bit more elegant, meaning that it had lots more white on it, and what would be a gentleman's companion. So he bred the bull terrier to look ferocious, and it does. I mean, you know, it looks ferocious. It's got those little triangular piggy-type eyes, and it looks like a fighting dog. But relatively speaking, it is a very gentle dog. So you can breed dogs to be either gentle or you can breed them to be aggressive. And we can control that breeding. But the only way we can control the breeding of specific dogs is through the generations over which we selectively mate dogs with either aggression or with low aggression. And in fact, the offspring of game-bred dogs, of these dogs which have been bred for fighting and that sort of thing, are in fact aggressive. We have instances where puppies of 6 and 7 weeks of age are killing some of their litter mates.
Oh, man.
Okay? I mean, that's how aggressive that these dogs get. And no, showering them with kindness is not going to help. You can't undo the DNA.
Now, I read some stories, though, of some pit bulls that were taken. They were kept in crates for all their life, where they were fighting dogs, and they were taken, and they were able to change the temperament of these dogs to the point where these dogs became, one became a therapy dog, one became a family pet, and also became an RCMP, or no, I'm sorry, not an RCMP, but a police dog sniffing out drugs. And, you know, within 5 months of having been taken out of horrendous conditions. So maybe it's not the norm, but...
Well, it's far from the norm. I mean, what we're dealing with here is, I mean, you know, when you're dealing with a population distribution, then, in fact, you're going to have some cases at either extreme. What this really means is that we have an expectation based on the data which says that these particular individuals are in fact going to be aggressive and are going to have lower thresholds for aggression. And yes, you will have instances in which, you know, dogs which have some game bred blood in their line you know, can in fact be reared, if you catch them early enough, to be reasonable dogs. Will they be 100% safe? No. Okay? I'll give you a couple of examples. I mean, we have one instance of somebody locally here in B.C. This is a woman who had Staffordshire Terriers for at least 25 years, and they had been wonderful dogs and that sort of thing. And then one day, I mean, she's elderly now, she slipped and fell. That startling movement of her falling was enough to have one of her dogs turn on her, and she ended up being savaged and ended up in the hospital. So, I mean, and these were dogs which, you know, for all intents and purposes, appeared to be, you know, quite reliable. They were certainly reared with love all of their entire life. We have the most recent example of the woman whose dog was shot. You know, she claimed that the dogs were in a tussle with each other and hadn't, you know, and the police officer had misread it. You know, but the police officer reported, and she confirmed, that in fact the woman had at least one major wound, which was spouting blood all over her. So that in fact, you know, these were not dogs, even though she had rescued them and reared them with love, which had been cured of their violence. And they were certainly being violent toward the other dogs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, I mean, all of us want to feel that somehow or another, something which we can do, you know, is going to be able to rehabilitate a dog, give it a second chance. The real thing which you have to understand is that at least half of a dog's behavioral repertoire is genetic in nature. And that's the reason why we have breeds. Mm-hmm. And we can control the temperament through the breed. Do you know where the word spaniel comes from?
No.
It comes from the root of for Spain, okay? And the reason is that all of the spaniels are very kissy-faced, loving dogs, and at the time which the breeds were being developed, you know, the great Latin lovers were supposed to be the Spaniards, okay? So, you know, there we have a case where the dogs had been bred so deliberately for that sort of temperament that it became part of their name.
That's very interesting. You're listening to You're listening to CFRO 102.7 FM. That's Vancouver's Co-op Radio. My name is Allart, and we're talking with Dr. Stanley Coren about dogs. Dr. Cohen, can you tell me now, with all of this in mind then, there's this breed-specific legislation that wants to ban certain of these pit bulls that you've mentioned, or these Staffordshire Terriers and whatnot, as well as other dogs, Rottweilers and Chow Chows and Dobermans and a variety of other dogs. What do you think about all of that?
Well, I actually testified before one of the committees in Ontario against the breed-specific legislation, but you have to understand the reasons why I testified against it. And what you have to do instead. The real concern that people have had is, you know, dogs biting people.
Mm-hmm.
And the first thing which you have to understand is that it is not an epidemic. The way that, you know, if you believe the media reports, then, you know, every 15 minutes a child is being eaten by a dog. In fact, in the U.S., we have data now going back at least 20 years in the U.S., the number of dog fatalities per year averages 12. That's for the entire U.S. That's for 56 million dogs,
mm-hmm.
Okay? So, I mean, that's not an epidemic. And in Canada, it averages typically 1 to 2 per year. The Ontario legislation was based on the fact that the dogs were perceived as being a threat to people. And so here the issue is, you know, dogs biting people. And you don't need breed-specific legislation to cut the incidence of dogs biting people. There is a study which was conducted by the American Association of Animal Hospitals, which showed that if you have a dog take a basic dog obedience course within the first couple years of that dog's life, and we're not talking about anything sexy. We're talking about where people stand around in a circle and you teach Lassie how to sit and Lassie how to lie down and that sort of thing. Then you reduce the number of accidents by 89%, the number of bite incidents, not accidents, by 89%. That's just by taking, you know, one dog obedience course. In addition, 50% of all of the dog bites, about half of all the dog bites, are to children. It turns out the data, for example, which I have collected here in BC, has shown that if you give kids a one-hour bite-proofing session, so you just bring in a dog, you have the kids sit around, and you teach them what to do not to get bitten, and this is not rocket science. They really have to learn three little tricks. You reduce the likelihood that that child, that any of the children there, will get bitten by 80%. And we tend to pick these bite-proofing sessions, we tend to do this for kids who are in third grade, so they're about 9 years of age. And we do that very deliberately because they can then take the message home. And it turns out that if you give one of these third graders a bite-proofing session, as I said, just 1 hour of classroom time, you also reduce the likelihood that any member of their family will get bitten by 60%. Because they go home, and if they see somebody in their family doing something wrong around the dog, they say, no, 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 don't do that. My teacher said.
Mm-hmm.
So, in fact, if you do that, if you can reduce the bite incidents by a single obedience class by 89%, and then another 80% by bite-proofing the kids, we have basically achieved a bite strength, a bite incidence reduction by about 95% without ever even identifying who the breeds are.
That's right.
So, I mean, you know, that's one of the ways that you can approach this thing. I mean, you just have differential licensing for dogs, you know. Mm-hmm. You get a dog license of one color if your dog has had a dog obedience class, and if you have the license of the other color, then you have to have your dog on muzzle. And you know, you've essentially eliminated the problem.
That makes sense.
The other thing is, I really don't believe that you should go after the dog owners, but after the dog breeders. So if you have a person whose dogs have been involved more than once in bite incidents, then that person ought to have their breeding license pulled. So, you know, you really have to do this at the source. And you can do it. I mean, you know, way back in the 1960s, people didn't talk about pit bulls as, you know, the devil dogs, which were the slavering beasts that ate children. At that time, were the Dobermans.
Mm-hmm.
And the Doberman people in the States said, you know, this is bad. You know, they're going to pass some kind of bad dog law on us. So they did something really quite heroic. They passed a temperament standard for their dogs. What this temperament standard says is that any dog which shows spontaneous aggression, that means to say he gets aggressive without being provoked, that dog would have its breeding certificate pulled. Now, the reason that's heroic is because a whole lot of very beautiful dogs are going to be prevented from breeding, and a lot of people are going to lose a lot of money because of that. But anyway, they did it. And in a period of less than 10 years, they changed the Dobermans from these very edgy dogs to what they are now, which is very solid working dogs. Yes, they will respond if somebody aggresses against them, but they will not spontaneously aggress. But that is here in North America. You see, in Europe, they still like their Dobermans with what they call temperamental fire. That means they're spontaneously aggressive. So if you bring a Doberman over from Europe, in fact, you have one of those slavering beasts that eat children. So, you know, this is controllable, but it's controllable through the breeding. And that's where you have to go. That's where the source is.
That makes sense, though. Of course, we can't have the owners be totally absolved of all responsibility, because it's like bad parents, you know.
I'm not saying you should absolve the owners. I'm saying that obviously if a person has a dog who is out of control, and especially if there's some reason to believe that that dog has been reared in some sort of abusive way so that it has been made to be out of control, I mean, obviously you should go after the owner, because as I said, you know, way back in the early part of this interview, you know, it is possible to take a good dog and make him bad.
Yeah.
Through rearing. So, I mean, yes, obviously the owner goes after it, but right now, the way the legislation is set up, that's all who you go after.
Yeah.
If there is a breeder who's out over there and generating three dozen bad, dangerous dogs a year, you know, we don't go after them.
Yeah, that's true. I'd like to shift gears here a little bit now and find out some about some of your other work with dogs. And one of the questions that I've always wondered about is where did domestic dogs come from? I mean, is at one point were there wild dogs and then they were taken from the wild and domesticated? How do we get all these different breeds of dogs that are domestic but not in the wild?
Well, it appears as though our dogs were domesticated a number of times at a number of different ages and in a number of different places, and also from a number of different species. I mean, one of the ways in which you determine whether something is the same species as something else is whether they can breed and produce live, fertile offspring. And in fact, our domestic dog can breed with wolves and jackals and coyotes and dingoes, with African wild dogs. They can even breed with certain foxes. Now, not the common red fox, because he's got the wrong number of chromosomes, but the beautiful white Arctic fox and the black Niger fox in southern southwestern U.S., you know, they can breed with those. So that seems to be evidence that all of those bloodlines are involved in our wild dogs. Now, what actually happened? Well, what actually happened was a selective procedure in which, in part, the dogs took the first steps to domesticate themselves. There was a character by the name of Dmitry Belyaev. He's a Russian geneticist. And he decided that he wanted to replay the process of domestication of dogs. And what he did was he selectively bred silver foxes. Now, the reason he selected silver foxes was twofold. First of all, silver foxes have the wrong number of chromosomes, so they can't breed with dogs. So, you know, it's obvious then that any genetic factors which we get are not because our domestic dogs have bred with these guys and brought their genes into the mix. And the second reason was that silver foxes are commercially valuable. Their pelts are used for various fur coats and that sort of thing. And so this was a Russian lab. They're always hungry for money. Since the silver foxes were commercially valuable, they could get applied agricultural funding for it. Anyway, what they did was they did a simple selective breeding kind of an experiment. And what they did was, essentially, they only bred the tamest of the foxes. Those are the ones who allowed people to approach, who were not fearful or aggressive. And ultimately, those who allowed people to actually touch them. And after some 35 generations, they basically had foxes which acted like dogs. They approached people, they wagged their tails, they yipped, and in fact, many of them are being sold now as pets in Russia. So essentially what he had done was he had replayed the way the domestication game occurred. Only it occurred in a very natural way, and the reason was that early man was a good hunter, but he was a slob. And so what he would do is he would take the bits and pieces, the unused bits and pieces of animals which he killed, and he'd throw it outside the edge of the village. And whatever the wild ancestors were of dogs in that region, whether they were wolves or jackals or dingoes or whatever else, they took a look at this, and, you know, they're opportunists. They say, you know, why should we go out and hunt and risk life and limb when here's this free buffet? So they hung out over there and began to sort of eat the garbage. And our ancestors tolerated that for two reasons. The first reason was that by eating the garbage, they kept down the vermin and the smell and that sort of thing. And the second one is that these animals came to sort of view the village as being their territory. So that means that if a stranger occurs or comes into the area, whether it's a wild beast or, you know, a band of other humans, they would set up the alarm by making a lot of noise. And this would give early warning to the village. And, you know, and these were dangerous times. I mean, you know, there were hostile beasts and hostile humans around. So this gave a defensive advantage. Now, what happens at this point in time is that the dogs which are least fearful, or the wolves, or let's pretend that we're just going to domesticate wolves in this case. Let's say the wolves which are the least fearful are not going to run away when humans come near the garbage pile. And in fact, if they hang around, they get the better food, they survive better. And essentially, their offspring are also not going to be fearful or aggressive. If they're at all aggressive toward human beings, obviously, at that time, they would just be simply eliminated as a matter of public safety. So eventually, what's happening over here is only the tamest and least fearful and friendliest of the animals are breeding near the village. Essentially, they are rerunning Belyaev's experiment, but they're doing it out in natural settings. And at that point, some very clever person said, hey, wait a minute. If these animals can alert us to problems outside of the village, then in fact, if I keep one in my house, he can serve as an alarm if anything comes near my house. So if it's a burglar, he's going to be a biological burglar alarm. But if it's somebody friendly, he'll just be a biological doorbell. And that's how dogs, which are already changed to be friendlier, end up inside our homes.
That's very interesting. Now, how, though, with all the different breeds, because I'm sitting here thinking, well, surely all the different looking breeds out there didn't all come from foxes and wolves and...
Oh, yes. Yes. I mean, if you...
Chihuahuas, itty bitty.
Okay, let's start with the beginning over here, right?
All right.
Okay, you have some wolves like the Russian Grey, which can be 160 pounds. Okay, you have some jackals, which can be as small as 25 pounds. Okay, there's huge range on these sorts of things. What happens is, let's say that Og the caveman and Ugg the caveman have now met from, they're from different villages in order to trade goods. And they brought along their domesticated animals. And Og had domesticated a wolf and Ugg had domesticated a jackal. Well, while these two guys are trading goods out front, the dogs, being dogs, are in the back trading genes.
Yes.
And that's how we get this wonderful varied palette of genetic material, which we can use to in our selective breeding, because they're all mixed in. Then human beings come along, and human beings begin to take over for these sort of normal processes by selective breeding. So, for example, we know that the little Pomeranians, which we have today, who are, you know, run about 9 pounds and maybe 8 inches at the shoulder, well, back in Queen Victoria's time, they were about 35 pounds. But because she found some smaller animals in Italy, which she liked, and so she brought them back with her, and everybody saw that Queen Victoria now had little Pomeranians, so that started this craze for breeding Pomeranians smaller and smaller.
I get it. Yeah, very interesting. Now I know. I've always wondered. Now, you do some interesting research with handedness, left-handedness. I'm wondering, do animals or dogs have a dominant paw?
No, dogs and cats don't have a dominant paw. That's not fully true, okay? Any one dog will tend to preferentially use his right or his left paw, or any one cat will tend to preferentially use his right or left paw. But if you look at the population, if you look at the distribution among all cats and dogs, 50% are right and 50% are left. Human beings are the oddballs in this case. We are the only species in which we have this huge difference, with 90% of us being right-handed and 10% of us being left-handed.
Mm-hmm. And so what then also, just to change the subject again, what skills do dog have, senses that they have that we don't have? We all know they've got a really heightened sense of smell. How about their other senses?
Well, their sense of smell is quite remarkable. I mean, people just have no real notion as to how different it is than ours. Inside your nose, you probably have about 5 million olfactory receptors. Lying next to me right now is a little beagle. He has in his nose 225 million olfactory receptors. Do you catch that?
Yeah.
5 versus 225, okay? They are living in a different world. Even though the dog's brain is considerably smaller than ours, he still has 40% more of brain material dedicated to analyzing smell than we do. So this is, I mean, this is an incredible beast. I mean, he detects things better than we can without literally, you know, three rooms full of physical sensing apparatus.
Mm-hmm. And And how about their other senses?
Well, when it comes to vision, it's a mixed bag for dogs. I mean, dogs were designed to be twilight and dawn hunters, so they're basically sort of designed for working under low light levels. And in fact, dogs have better night vision than we do, and they're also extremely sensitive to movement. So they can detect things moving very, very easily. But their color vision is more limited than ours. They see the world in shades of blues and yellows. Their visual acuity is very poor. If dogs could drive, they'd all be required to wear corrective lenses. Okay? Since the cutoff for impaired vision, which, you know, if your vision is 20/40 or worse, then in fact you have to wear glasses. Well, our dogs are probably about 20/55, their life is a little bit blurry. It's like looking through cellophane, which you've had a little slick of Vaseline on. Now, their hearing is a mixed bag. Lots of people, have the sense that dogs' hearing is considerably better than ours. And that's only partially true. When it comes to hearing things in the range of human speech, so those frequencies which we tend to use and to understand when we're talking to other individuals and so forth, there's absolutely no difference between a dog's hearing and ours. However, in the high frequencies, dogs are much more sensitive than us. So they can pick up sounds which are much, much higher than us. So if you think of it this way, suppose that we have a piano, and if I wanted to extend the right side of the piano up to the highest note that a human being could hear, I would have to extend that piano up by 22 keys. Now, if I want to extend that piano up the highest note which a dog can hear, then I would have to extend that up 54 keys. So that basically means that the last 32 keys, which the dog can hear, we would be unable to hear.
Okay. How about the sense of touch or even their feelings? You're a psychologist. What about dogs' feelings?
Well, I mean, if you're talking about emotions, that's a whole different bag, okay? If you want to understand the psychology of the dog, there's a rule of thumb which will get you through a whole lot of problems. And that is, pardon me, the mind of a dog of an average dog, is roughly about equivalent to a mind of a two-year-old, and of the super dogs, maybe a two-and-a-half-year-old. So that tells us a whole lot about their language abilities, for example. So the average dog can understand about 165 words, and that includes signs and symbols and that sort of thing. And the super dogs may be up to about 250 to 300 words. So if we keep that rule of thumb that dogs have the mind of a, let's call it a two-and-a-half-year-old here, then since we know that two-and-a-half-year-olds have certain emotional capabilities, then so will the dog. And the dog has all the basic emotions, which would be fear and anger, surprise, pleasure, that sort of thing. But they don't have any of the learned emotions. So, for example, guilt is a learned emotion. Most humans don't learn guilt until they're 4, 4.5 years of age, and I teach at the university, and I'm sure that there are many 18 and 19-year-olds out there who haven't learned it yet. So dogs are not going to have guilt, okay? And it's just simply not there. It's not in their repertoire. Now, there is one other thing which we do have to add to that emotional life of dogs. The first thing is they have the emotions of a 2, 2.5-year-old, but the social consciousness of a teenager. So they really do have this sort of concern about who's moving up in the pack, who's moving down in the pack, who's pushy, who's sleeping with who, and that sort of thing. So basically, you have an animal which is working at 2.5 years of age, for most of his functions, but, you know, as far as social things are concerned, he's going to act like a 13 or a 14-year-old.
And how does functioning emotionally as a equivalent to a 2-year-old fit with, some dogs are really intelligent, and they figure a lot of things out that you wouldn't think a 2-year-old would be able to figure out.
Well, a 2.5-year-old can do quite a bit. I mean, there are, it depends on the dogs, okay? You know, there are systematic differences in the intelligence of dogs. You know, I did that research back in the 90s, and we recently put out a new edition of the intelligence of dogs with some new data and that sort of thing. And there are some dogs which are very, very bright and learn very well, and there are others... Well, they're pretty and they're fun. I mean, so
they're dingbats is what you're saying, okay?
Well, I mean, when we did the research, it became very, very clear that that dogs like border collies and poodles and German shepherds and golden retrievers and Dobermans and Labs and Shelties, you know, were very, very bright dogs. Those are the top 7 dogs. On the other hand, I mean, the dog which is resting next to me is a Beagle, okay? Mm-hmm. In terms of this working and obedience intelligence, which is what we're ranking in this case, you know, the Beagle is 7 from the bottom. That means the chair that you're sitting on is more trainable than a Beagle, okay? Now, you know, some people say to me, well, I mean, you did all that research. Why did you get yourself such a dumb dog? Well, I mean... You know, first of all, we tend not to pick our lovers as on the basis of their intelligence. We certainly are not going to get rid of our kids if they flunk a math test, right? You know, and in fact, you know, I tend to choose my dogs on the basis of how they will fit into my lifestyle. So, for example, at this moment in time, I have 9 grandchildren. And some of them are quite young and clutchy and that sort of thing. And Beagles are incredibly sociable, friendly dogs, relatively unbreakable. You know, they're not going to get hurt by the kids. And also, in this particular case, the dog not being, you know, Harvard medical material is very useful because that means to say he's apt to forget that this particular kid was the one who pinched his ear an hour ago.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. Dr. Cohen, we are out of time. I wish I had more time to talk with you. Should we give out your website if anybody wants to come and check out your work?
Sure. It's www.stanley, S-T-A-N-L-E-Y, Coren, Coren.com.
That's great. Thank you so much for being on the show with me today, Dr. Coren. I really enjoyed it. It's been very informative.
All right. You take care of it.
Thank you. You too.
Right. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to CFRO 102.7 FM. The show is called Animal Voices. My name is Allert, and we've just been talking with Dr. Stanley Coren about his work with dogs, his incredible knowledge and his research with dogs. The show will be back next week. Please come back and join us. Thank you all for listening.